Main menu.
Main menu.
Main menu.
Main menu.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mosen, and on Main Menu this week, Freedom Scientific are the new owners of Henter Joyce and Blazy Engineering. Ted Henter explains what it all means for you and me. A new internet portal for blind people is launched. We find out what we can expect from EnableLink.com. Broadcast to the world over the internet, we speak with three blind people who tell us the secrets of their success. BrailleNote is a Windows CE-based portable note-taker for the blind, and it was officially launched in New Zealand this week. ACB Radio was there for the hands-on demonstration. DJC unravels the mysteries of Internet Relay Chat, and Matt Campbell is here for his weekly Look at Linux. All this to come over the next 2 hours on ACB Radio Mainstream's Main Menu. People with their ears close to the ground in the blindness technology industry know that Ted Henter and Dean Blazy are good friends, and that they've often talked about how one day they'd like to merge their two companies. Yet it's such an old story that most people stopped listening to the rumours that would quickly surface and vanish. Yet for most people, it was a shock to learn that a new company in the disability market, headed by the former CEO of a medical supplies company, had purchased two of the leading companies in the blindness technology market, Henter Joyce and Blazy Engineering, thus at last putting Ted Henter and Dean Blazy in the same company. The takeover wasn't hostile. On the contrary, it was actively encouraged by both Dean Blazy and Ted Henter. Well, on the line with us now is Ted Henter, now one of the vice presidents of Freedom Scientific, and that's a name that we're all going to be getting used to over the next little while. Ted, tell us, why is this, first of all, a good business move for Henter Joyce to have made?
Dean Blazy and I have been friends for 20 years. I bought my first talking computer from him in 1980, and I worked with him for about 4 years, from 81 to 85, and we've been friends ever since. He's given me a lot of good advice over the years as far as running a business, developing products, things like that. And I think I've helped him out a little bit, too, on such questions. And our products, you know, work together. We don't compete. Our products work well together. So we've always kind of had this in mind. We've wanted to get together on a more formal basis, to get our company together. But that's hard to do when you have two very independent, small companies like ours. So when we met this fellow, Dick Chandler, who is the CEO and president of Freedom Scientific, we started talking to him, and one thing led to another. It looked like that would be the proper vehicle to do this, to merge the two companies. Having an outside entity to kind of organize it and finance it and be the boss, so to speak. You know, neither Dean or I are taking control of the company. There's a third party. So that just worked out real good. Both of us were quite happy with that kind of arrangement. You know, I didn't want to work for him. He didn't want to work for me. I didn't want him running my company and vice versa. It's all those ego type of things, among other practical considerations. So having a third party involved it just worked out really well. So we feel the big advantage here is our products already work well together. We'll be able to focus on some development efforts together, on some sales and marketing efforts together. The company together has more resources to develop new products and to refine the products that we have. So overall, it looks like a very good situation going forward.
So why is this good news for blind people then?
The good news for blind people is what I just said at the end there, is that with this stronger development effort and stronger support capability, we'll just be able to develop better products. Better products, cheaper products, get them out in the hands of more and more people, promote them around the world to benefit more and more people. As you know, this technology is almost essential for a blind person to use in the modern age to get jobs and education, to do some recreational things, to manage the home. So the more people can have access to these products, the better it is, plus the better the products are, the better it's going to be for our customers. So we feel this just puts both of us in a much better position to develop even better products.
Will there be any job losses as a result of this merger?
No. We don't see any job losses as a result of this merger. Certainly here at Henry Joyce, we don't, because this will be the headquarters of the Blindness and Low Vision Group. But part of the Blasey company that's in Maryland, part of that will be moving to Florida. So some people will choose not to move. But there are no job losses other than that.
It may be a bit early to start talking about this, but there may well be some interesting synergies that can occur between what Blasey has been doing and what HJ has been doing in terms of, say, you've got a screen reader, they've got Braille displays. Might we see perhaps a new line of Braille note takers that run under Windows using JAWS as their screen reader and Blasey's Braille technology?
It's too early to tell about that. We have our own development schedule out to 2 or 3 years, and so do they. So right now, it's not clear where the synergies are going to be in development. We already support their Braille displays and their note takers, you know, the Braille Light and the Power Brailles. And we intend to continue to do that. If in the future they need a screen reader for one of their note takers, then we're the obvious choice to do that or help them develop that. But right now there are no plans to do that. Even though we support their Braille display, we also support all the other Braille displays, and we aim to continue that support as well.
There is a concern that when you get a large company like this, that is dealing in a number of disability markets, and I see from the release that Freedom Scientific will also be dealing with learning disability, that because learning disability is a larger market, more resources tend to get put into that area. Do you see that as a concern, and how would it be averted?
It's not a concern, because we, that is Freedom Scientific, will be maintaining what you might call the entrepreneurial model. That is, Henter Joyce will remain separate from Blasey Engineering, separate in location and separate in focus and separate in development efforts and all that sort of stuff. And likewise, as other companies get added to the fold, so to speak, they will be separate from us. So each entity is able to focus on their own little niche. And our goal, each entity's goal or each division's goal, is to make the world's best products in that area. So if there is a development project going on for, let's say, learning disabilities, it's very likely that we will not be involved with it. Now, perhaps some of our technology might, but our focus here at Henry Joyce will remain screen readers and magnifiers. But as other product lines are added, as they fit in with us, yeah, we will take up some of the development effort, probably. It just depends on the structure.
So that means, for instance, that when somebody gets their JAWS for Windows next release or a new update of the Braille Light or whatever it is, that people will still see the Henter Joyce brand or the Blasey Engineering brand in the copyright information and on the publicity material. Is that how it will work?
That's exactly right, Jonathan. We are officially now known as Henter Joyce, a division of Freedom Scientific. And likewise, Blasey is Blasey Engineering, a division of Freedom Scientific, and we'll continue to operate that way. Now, as I was saying before, with another totally different type of technology, like a learning disability, we will not be involved in developing that product because we're experts in blindness and low vision, not that learning disability end of this industry.
There will be, according to the release, some merging of sales and marketing aspects. I wonder about technical support and whether you can see any merging prospects there, because in recent times, particularly Blasey has come under considerable criticism for the quality of its maintenance agreement for Braille Lights, etc., and the fact that people getting refurbished Braille Lights are often getting lemons, to be quite frank, and people are getting extremely dissatisfied out there about that. Is that an issue that's going to be addressed?
Well, two answers there. The latter one about the dissatisfaction, I can't comment on that because I just don't know anything about that, frankly. But regarding the structure or how our tech support will be organized, they will be separate. Because we feel that tech support is a very important part of development. These are our tech support guys and girls that we We learn where the problems are, we learn where the bugs are, and so we need to keep that close to development. And so we decided early on that tech support would stay with each development group. So that means that the HJ tech support will stay here along with our developers, and the Blazy tech support will stay over there along with their developers. In this case, over there means Stuart, Florida. And in our case, we're in St. Petersburg, Florida. We're about 125 miles apart.
I know that one can get used to anything, but sort of intuitively, the name Freedom Scientific doesn't sort of roll off the tongue very readily. I wondered where the name came from, and also if you can tell us a bit more about Dick Chandler and why he's interested in this market.
Yeah, you're perhaps right about Freedom Scientific. It's very natural now to me because I've been hearing it for maybe 6 months. And I think it's definitely something that grows on. But be that as it may, Dick Chandler has been in the disability or products for disabled people field for about 20 years now. 17, I think. I think it was in 83 that he started a company called Sunrise Medical, which turned out to be one of the top two developers and manufacturers of wheelchair equipment and hospital beds and breathing apparatus and things like that, the type of things that you need when you get out of the hospital. And that's a pretty big company now, and he resigned from the CEO position of that last fall because he saw this high-tech area and wanted to get into it. That was a lot more exciting than what he was doing and wanted to get into it. He's a professional manager. He's got experience with Fortune 500 companies and has experience in building companies like Sunrise Medical. He built that basically from scratch up to about a $600 million company over about 15 to 16 years. So a lot of good experience in that and knows a lot about financing and managing companies and getting the products to the customers, developing the products the customers want. So he has a lot of experience in building products for people with disabilities, but none at all in this particular field, blindness and low vision. So we're trying to teach him what we know, and of course he's bringing a lot of his managerial and business building, let's say, expertise to the party. So it's a very good combination. Somebody like that is the right person for this type of job. Putting these two companies together, getting the maximum synergy out of them. And then Freedom Scientific, the parent company, will be looking at, you know, other companies and other fields, such as learning disabilities. So in time, I think you'll learn a lot more about Dick. He's a very good experience, a lot of skill, a lot of capability, and a lot of interest, you know, in this field. As the press release said, something about the goal is to change the world for people with disabilities. Of course, that means we're going to change it for the better. And we're going to do that through just developing better products, getting that to more people.
You made the comment in the press release, I think it might have been both you and Dean made this comment, that you really felt that you'd been caught up in a lot of the administrative side of what you were doing as your companies got bigger. So what sort of work do you expect to be doing now with Freedom Scientific as you take on this new role?
I'm very pleased with that, actually, Jonathan, because you know as the business grew, you know, we've got about 71 people here now. That's a big responsibility. And we had to be very careful about the types of things we committed money and resources to as far as development efforts. Very careful about our sales and marketing efforts. We had to be sure that, you know, the company survived. We just had a lot of responsibility, commitment to the people here. We still have that commitment, of course, but we're stronger and as a merged company, and there's more resources, more financial backing. And that's, so I'm very happy about that. And what that does for me is it allows me to move over to a different activities. I'll be the vice president of advanced developments, which is kind of a fancy title. It doesn't mean a heck of a lot. And I'm going to continue to work with our development group, perhaps a little bit with our sales and marketing group. Kind of odd jobs that maybe my experience and, shall we say, skill level would suit. Mainly, I've been working with the developers all along, but not actually doing any development myself, and as far as programming goes. I don't intend to get back into programming, but I'll probably be just working more and more with the developers and helping to develop the new products.
Now, I guess that this question may have been better directed for Dean, but there's a lot of interest in the Opticon, and despite all of the technologies that are now out there with OCR, people still love their Opticons and are getting very worried about what will happen when they break. And Dean has expressed some interest in the Opticon. Do you know anything about what the future for the Opticon will be with Freedom Scientific?
No. Honestly, I do not have a clue what their plans are or the details on the product. So hopefully sometime in the near future you get a chance to talk to Dean and get that information.
We'll look forward to that. Now, the question that we've been asked to ask by the most people is, of course, the question about exhibiting at conventions and what the policy for Freedom Scientific will be. There have been many people who feel quite alienated and angry about the fact that Blazy had made a decision to exhibit at one convention and not the other. Will you be exhibiting jointly now as Freedom Scientific, and if so, are you going to both conventions?
Oh, that's a good question. Frankly, I hadn't thought about that, so best thing I can say is I don't know. For one thing, it's not up to me to decide. And for two, I just haven't had a chance to think about it, so I don't even know what to tell you.
Whose decision is that now in terms of convention exhibiting?
Well, ultimately, it'll be Dick Chandler. But he'll be taking advice from me and Dean and a lot of other people at each company. So I can't say about that. Don't know.
You have been talking about it for a long time. I mean, these rumors have been surfacing for ages, on and off about you and Dean coming up with this merger. But you were saying just earlier that it's been in the melting pot for about 6 months, this Freedom Scientific proposal.
Yes. Yep, sure has.
What goes on during those processes, Ted? I mean, how does something like this start and come to a conclusion?
Well, Dean and I have been talking about this for years, actually. And about a year ago, we here at Henner Choice found this guy Dick Chandler and started talking to him, got him interested in us and vice versa. Then last fall is when this idea about Freedom Scientific really started to form. So the way it came about was, we were looking for someone like a Blazy to merge with, and like I said earlier, there were problems with just Dean and I doing it, by ourselves, so to speak. We're looking to have more strength and more resources for development. So, talking with Dick through the summer, talking about some various possibilities, he is the guy that went out and raised the money to basically do the deal. And what has happened is he has in effect bought Blazy and Henner Choice. And we are part owners. We, that is Blazy and I, are part owners of the new company. That is the new company, Freedom Scientific. So we're stockholders in that. And he kind of put together the corporate structure and the financing. And over the past, let's say, 6 months, maybe eight, come to think of it, we negotiated this, negotiated that, and kind of got everything worked out. It was a much more complicated process than I thought it was. It was going to be much more complicated. But I've never done this before, so I didn't have a clue.
And just finally, do you think that this is going to start some sort of trend? Will there be other mergers in the assistive technology industry to respond to what's happened with you and Blazy Engineering?
Hadn't thought about that. I suppose that's a real possibility. We'll just have to wait and see. It makes really good sense for us. I'm very pleased with the way it came about and the fact that it has come about. Now, if it makes that much sense for other companies, I'm not sure. But I'm very pleased with the way it's turning out here.
Freedom Scientific's Ted Henter. You're listening to Main Menu on ACB Radio Mainstream. I'm Jonathan Mosen. Portals, portals everywhere. Portal seems to be the internet buzzword of the moment, but there's no portal exclusively for the blind and vision impaired. That is, until now. Stephanie Ball-Bassler is in charge of EnableLink.com, and she joins us on the line now. Stephanie, tell us a little bit about EnableLink.com and its mission.
Okay, well, what enablelink.com is it's a community site for people who are blind or have low vision, their families, friends, colleagues. The idea is to create kind of sort of something similar to iVillage or theglobe.com, but with a specific community in mind. The idea, we have a lot of original content, and we're trying to put together something that's about life. It's not about blindness or visual impairments, but it always considers it in everything that it does. You know, for instance, if we do travel features, we will not obsess about things. We'll talk about the place, but we would also include the fact that we would know that our audience would want to have information about certain things, for instance, you know, mass transit and travel alternatives.
So you're really looking at general purpose issues with a blindness angle, if you will.
Exactly. Trying to get the idea that people have a lot of different and diverse interests, but that sometimes there's special information that helps people pursue their interests. Another example is we have a home buying column that for the most part is 95% generic what to do to buy a house, but then includes a little bit of information that's specific to people with visual impairments. For instance, loan programs that are offered by Freddie Mac in the United States that are specifically targeted to people with disabilities.
I suppose it also really demonstrates the power of the internet in the sense that buying a house has probably become a lot easier for blind people thanks to the internet, that you can kind of let your fingers do the walking on the keyboard a little bit. And a lot of these ads that you can now shop for or shop with have quite good descriptions of the different properties, which can be quite helpful before you go and wander around the place.
Exactly. And to take that a little bit further, you go to any kind of shopping, books, groceries, you know, dog food, you name it, it's a lot more accessible on the internet in many ways than it is in the store. You don't have to worry about getting transportation to the store. You don't have to worry about finding someone in the store or bringing a friend along who's willing to help you. The problem, of course, now still is, though, that a lot of these sites aren't very accessible. One of the things we're hoping to do with EnableLink is work with other sites to say, look, these are the simple things that you need to do, and here's an audience that would be quite willing to use your site and probably use it very religiously. You know, if someone is sighted, maybe they want to use online grocery, maybe they don't. I think if someone has a visual impairment, they're a lot more likely to want to use online grocers because it is much simpler and much easier if the site's accessible, which is the issue that still exists with a lot of these sites. Because we're getting an association with a lot of different sites, in particular we're doing an affiliate program with Amazon and CD Now, we hope to be able to use the information about the traffic on our site to go to them and say, look, you spend a lot of money acquiring customers. We have customers who you only have to spend a minimal amount of money to make some minor changes to your site that will make this a great place for them to shop and for them to interact with. So it's kind of a type of advocacy through traffic, site traffic.
So are you providing links to these shopping sites? Obviously, in the case of the affiliate programs, you will be, but are you also selling your own material? Because I noticed that you were referring on your site to links to assistive technology products.
Yes. We're selling a lot of assistive technology products ourselves. We are more or less selling them on behalf of either the companies or the distributors of the products. So we're not necessarily servicing each product that we sell. For instance, one of the things that we're selling is the Duxbury Braille translation software, and that's through an agreement with Duxbury where they're going to directly ship it to you. So you order it from us. We handle the information, so your credit card information isn't going all over the place. We're processing the credit cards, but then the order is going to get shipped to Duxbury or Henry Joyce or whoever you've ordered from, and you'll get it directly from them.
The blind community, particularly when you break it down further and say the blind community that is using computers, I guess is not terribly large. So how will the site be sustainable, do you think?
Well, I think it's sustainable in two ways. One is obviously through direct sales of assistive technology products. And the second way is through associate programs. While there aren't that many people yet getting online, it's growing every day. The numbers support that if we get a good enough portion of the people who are already out there using the internet and we're able to provide them with accessible shopping through our site, that the revenue will be there. We're not, in a lot of ways, we don't have the kind of expenses that maybe an Amazon or somebody else might have, or Globe, because we're not, you know, going to spend big amounts of money on television commercials. We're going to pretty much go through word of mouth. So I think it's affordable in that way. I think if people come to the site and use the site to go out and do grocery shopping, or gift shopping or whatever, that those kind of activities will help support us, and that's our hope.
Are you officially launched yet, or did you just launch and make it a reasonably soft launch when you did?
Well, we made a soft launch at CSUN, and that was primarily to reach out to people who would want to partner with our site. The idea is to get in with a lot of other people in the community who may want to partner with us. For instance, we have a university who has an online learning program that we're going to try to incorporate into our site. We talked to a lot of different companies at CSUN about creating relationships to kind of go back and forth. So this will be more of a diverse community and not just what it is right now. This week is really when we're starting to go out and launch in terms of the consumer base. So you probably wouldn't have heard about it because we haven't publicized it. But within the next couple of weeks, we will have links on the Microsoft Enable site. We'll have links in several different places. We'll appear in the Braille Monitor shortly. So you'll start seeing it in more places, and that really is going to launch about next week.
So you think it's quite important then to work with consumer organizations, like, for instance, you just mentioned the Braille Monitor, and here you are on ACB Radio. So those consumer organization established networks are quite important, I guess.
Oh, absolutely, because in a lot of ways, a website like this needs to be kind of like a virtual downtown. And if it's a virtual downtown, then it needs all the voices. And it needs, a diversity of opinion and a diversity of people participating. So if all the content on the site just emanated from myself and a handful of contributors, I think it wouldn't have any value, really. It's got to be a place where you can kind of go and see the range of the community. You know, you can kind of go from page to page in a way. It's like going from shop to shop or street to street in a community. You meet different people, you get different ideas, and you can interact with a wider range than you might otherwise if you went to just a specific site. Say, well, I'm going to go to this person's site. For instance, being able to even share content. One of the big things in the mainstream internet world is what they call a distribution deal. And that is that you have a site and I have a site and they're kind of mutually reinforcing. Well, instead of just linking to your site, I actually carry some of your content on your site, and I allow you to carry some of my content. So we're both enriched by the experience. We both drive traffic to one another, and now I've got opinion and content on my site that I probably otherwise wouldn't have, either because I don't have the resources or I never thought of it.
The articles that you're putting up there, I noticed a very interesting one from a contributor on dealing with the Nokia mobile phone company trying to make an accessible mobile phone, which I found fascinating. Are you actively seeking people from the blind community around the world to write articles? And if so, are they paid for their contributions?
Well, absolutely. We're soliciting people to contribute. And the answer to paid for the contributions right now is no. We're really putting this together on a shoestring, mostly with people just putting in their time and their effort to do it. However, as the site becomes more successful, as we begin, if this model works and we begin to generate revenue through our associate agreements and through the shopping that's on our site, then of course, we would begin to bring people on as paid, writers and editors and whatnot. But right now we're not in a position to do that.
And I guess a project like this takes a long time to put together. Have you been working on it a wee while now?
Well, in a lot of ways, yeah, I'd say about a year since we really started talking about it and thinking about it. EnableLink is owned and run by a company called DeWitt & Associates, of which I'm the vice president. And we work, we do a lot of work in the state of New Jersey and in the northeast of the United States, doing assistive technology consulting and design. We have about 7 different programs we run in the state of New Jersey. And EnableLink kind of came out of working with people and wanting to find and finding out that more and more people were using computers, getting on the internet, and there really wasn't a place to go. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there was a launch of another disabilities website called We Media a couple of months ago. And again, they touted themselves as being for the disability community, but it really wasn't accessible. They used a lot of bells and buzzers and tricks that make the site very difficult to navigate. So in our work and working with, we kind of started coming up with the idea that it would be nice to have a place to go. Worked about how we're going to fund this place to go, how we're going to make it work, because DeWitt & Associates, we're a for-profit company. Shortly was born. I'm the editor of it. I do probably about 85% of the work to put it together. But I'm beginning to get up a pretty good stable of people who want to contribute. We have a travel agent who's going to start contributing. We're going to do a series on internet dating from that we've gotten from a number of people. We also are going to have some articles on music, more book articles, that sort of thing.
One thing that really struck me as interesting was the concept of the navigation guide. Now, I don't recall seeing that anywhere else, and I wonder if that's a concept that you've come up with, but you do have a navigation guide for your own site, and you're talking about providing navigation guides for other sites. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, a very important part of the site, and the idea is that some sites are almost there. You know, they're 80% accessible, but there may be some issues, and because we do a lot of work on the Internet, what we want to do is go out and review popular sites that we believe people will have an interest in and provide them with a navigation guide to kind of say, okay, you know, when you get to the site, this is probably what you're going to hear. Here are the things that you might have a problem with. Best example I can think of is I believe it was one of the music sites, I won't name it, but where you could get through your whole order, but when you got to the end of your order, you could not order anything because it was an unmarked button on the bottom of the page that if you tabbed past it, it said nothing. You could land on it, but it would say nothing. In that instance, we might be able to give you the advice that says, you know, when you're on the link that says, you know, Bob Smith, tab twice, you know, and you'll be on the right button. And we won't say you're on the right button, but that's where you'll be. Hit enter and you'll go. That sort of information to help people navigate sites where there's just one thing that may be in their way that's stopping them from enjoying the site. And we can kind of enlighten them, say, here it is. This is how we figured out how to get around it.
In terms of your contact with the provider of these affiliate-type deals, such as Amazon and CD Now, and there are lots of them about, I'm wondering whether you've had an opportunity at this stage to talk to the web design people about our needs as blind and vision-impaired people, and whether they've been terribly receptive or whether we're such a small market that they don't really care at this stage.
Well, I'd say some have been receptive. Some I'm not getting anywhere. As a matter of fact, I'm taking a visit to Internet World this week in Los Angeles to try to do some personal flacking with folks. I think they're not that receptive, but again, what we're hoping is if we can drive traffic through our site and we can get numbers to say this many people are visiting, and we're fairly sure the number would be fairly high. We talked to the people over at Microsoft, and their Enable site gets about 400,000 hits a month. Sites like Amazon and CD Now have a very, very high cost of acquisition, which is the amount of money it costs them to get one person who actually comes and buys something on their site. I think if you could turn around with numbers like 400,000 hits a month, even that small of a number, and say, you know, here's an audience that's just waiting for you to do a couple of little things, and then if we can also turn around and give them that information so they don't have to search for it, you know, we could say, here's the code, because you can look at the source code. And you could tell them exactly what they need to do. I think they'd find it hard to turn down because they're spending an awful lot of money to acquire people who visit their sites and who actually buy at their sites. So I think that once we get the numbers, those people begin to become more receptive to listening to us.
Of course, that 400,000 hits is the disability community in general, I guess, and then you've got to work out what kind of a subset the blind community is of that 400,000 hits.
Mm-hmm. But also keep in mind, that's 400,000 hits of people who are technically enough oriented that they want to go see the Microsoft site. I think that one of the things that kind of get missed in all the organizations is that you have a lot of folks out there who have vision difficulties as they grow older, who have children and who are on the internet, who buy them computers, who really don't kind of get linked into any of the organizations because they lose their vision later in life. They're dealing with an ophthalmologist who kind of doesn't really point them to anything or say anything. I had a similar experience. I had a grandmother who lost her vision at 85, and basically for 10 years until she died, sat in a chair and did nothing, not because she didn't have the resources, but because we really didn't understand it, and we didn't know who to contact, and we didn't know who to deal with. And one of the advantages of having a website and getting yourself on search engines is that a granddaughter or a daughter or a sister or a husband who sits down at the Internet can find this information now, which didn't happen before. And I think those aren't necessarily people who are going to the Microsoft Enable site. That's a whole other pool of people who I think will come to a site like EnableLink to find out more information and to kind of figure out what to do.
And do you think that the legal pressures that are starting to be exerted, I guess it's kind of a tug of war between those who are trying to make sure that the ADA applies to the internet and those who are trying to make darn sure that it never does, but is that starting to have some influence in terms of web designers taking notice of our needs?
A little. I think there's a wait and see attitude for the people that I talk to. They're kind of saying, well, you know, it's AOL's problem right now because they're the big hit, you know, they're the big target right now. They kind of want to wait and see what happens. But I think that sites, you know, actually the Wall Street Journal had an article not too long ago and they called it anti-capitalism. The idea that, you know, putting your money where your mouth is and being able to influence people because you are a possibility of being a revenue source for these companies. I think kind of it's a twofold approach. I think these lawsuits are putting pressure on one side, and then if we can also put encouragement on the other side to say, look, there's a reason for you not to wait for the for the AOL lawsuit to be settled and see how this turns out, because you're turning away customers. And you can't afford to do that in a market that is so competitive right now where people aren't even making a profit. You know, they really can't afford to turn away customers. The problem is getting good information to them. Most of these web designers don't even know that there's such a thing as accessibility standards. They just don't. You know, they're not member, you know, they don't go to any of these organizations. They just, you know, got a job doing HTML and they're working for someone. I am a member of an organization called Web Girls, and, you know, the first time I posted anything about accessibility, everybody was like, what are you talking about? They had no idea. So I think it's twofold. I think the lawsuit begins to make people understand, but on the other hand, we have to put pressure in a lot of different places as far as making them aware that, you know, it's not something you need to do only because the law is going to make you do it. It's something that's simply a good idea for your company.
Accessibility probably has a bit of bad press and has a bad name, I imagine, with web designers, because you put a site through something like Bobby, and the site mm-hmm. can be perfectly accessible, and Bobby will tell you that it's not and tell you a million different things that you have to do. And I get the impression that most web designers who really aren't in contact with the blind community think that accessibility is all about taking away every graphic on their page and making plain text, and that's why they're so resistant.
Right. I agree. I mean, a good example of that is if you look at Amazon has a quote-unquote text-only page, which I imagine they created to make it more accessible, but it's laughable because all they've done is simply removed all the pictures, and they've done nothing to make the page more accessible. So I think that you're right, that people don't really understand what accessibility is. They're afraid of it. They're afraid it's going to have to make them make ugly web pages that nobody's going to like. But I think one of the other things that's happening right now that's very interesting is this whole wireless website, okay, the wireless application protocol. In order to make a good wireless website, you really, in a lot of ways, have to follow the requirements of a good accessible page. You don't want, if you're working with a Palm Pilot or a small handheld device, you don't want a page that's full of 128 links that you've got to click through before you get to the first link that matters, which is very common on a lot of web pages. So I think that the wireless protocol, in a lot of ways, is going to marry very nicely with accessibility, because in a lot of ways it's the same concepts. And if you can get it through people that the same thing that makes a site accessible also makes a very good wireless site, then I think you also can make some headway in that way, because everybody's going to have to learn that what makes a good wireless site. You know, there's a big market. In a lot of ways, I compare it to curb cuts. You know, they were made, you know, and required for people with wheelchairs, but now everybody loves them. You know, people using strollers, people carrying, you know, rolling their groceries in a basket. Everybody likes curb cuts and doesn't understand that they weren't always there. And I think the same thing is going to happen with accessible design, because wireless pages are going to require accessible design.
Well, the other exciting thing is, of course, that people are talking about the ability to do their web surfing in their cars, and that is causing a lot of work to be done in the whole area of speech input and output. So, you know, it may be that there will be a convergence of our needs versus the need of the general populace.
Exactly, and I think that we have to advocate, though, to make sure that people see it, because I think it's helpful. I think there's a lot of ground that's already been covered in our group that says, you know, we already have discovered what works and what doesn't. Why don't you learn from our experience, and it'll help you. If you notice in the Nokia article, one of the things that Lisa talks about was that the people at Nokia understand that an accessible cell phone is also marketable in that market. You're talking about web browsing in your car. You know, Nokia understands very well that make an accessible phone, and all of a sudden you have a phone that people can use while they're driving without having to look at the keyboard. It's really nice. There's a very, very huge market for that, you know. The market then goes from, you know, maybe, you know, the two million people, who might require an accessible cell phone to the vast majority of people who drive in a car. So I think that those kind of things are going to be pretty interesting. And if Nokia does it and manages to do it, and they're working very hard on it, you'll see everybody else follow suit, because that's going to be a wonderful contraption to have, is this, you know, web browser that you can talk to in your car. It's the stuff of science fiction.
So is this a potential revenue stream source for EnableLink.com to provide this kind of consultancy advice on what is required to the big web designers?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one way we're looking at supporting the site. The other way we're looking at supporting the site is to actually help people design shopping sites that are accessible and are really easy to use, and linking them to our site.
Yeah, that is a big controversy, of course, because there have been so many difficulties with internet shopping, and it holds so much promise, the fact that you can browse the shelves independently and choose the product item you want, and yet the reality is that often internet shopping can be a frustrating experience. So would you look at kind of providing your own interface to those sites, perhaps getting another way into their CGI scripts to complete the purchase or whatever, or would you be more willing to have them design their general purpose site to make it accessible?
To be honest with you, my preference would be to design it our own way and have it go into, you know, and have it dump into their CGI scripts. I think that, if you look at the Enable Link site, from a visual perspective, it is very, very simple. And it's very simple for a reason, because we have an audience. We cater to that audience, and that's who we want to please. And so we really don't put anything on our site that is for pure visual fun, you might say, and doesn't have a real purpose to be there. That's a choice that we make. I don't expect Amazon.com or, you know, NetGrocer to necessarily make that choice. I have lots of ideas about better ways to shop. If you go into our shopping cart is very simple and easy to use when you buy the accessibility products. I think that we could create very easy to use. Grocery store is a perfect example. You know, grocery store site for visually impaired should be just basic. You have your aisles, your categories, your items. You should be able to read a description of the item, you know, check it off and order it. It should be that simple. It shouldn't be going through 10 pages to get to the can of soup. And in fact, I think that in a lot of ways, again, we go right back to wireless protocol. That's exactly the same way that they're going to do it on wireless. If you're sitting there trying to order a couple of things from the grocery store in your car, you're not going to want to go through a bunch of, you know, ads and this, that, and every other thing to get to a can of soup. So those kind of pages, I think, should be specially designed, if we can get the companies to agree to it, because I think it's just much more effective that way than trying to kind of co-opt an existing page to make it easier to use.
And that's Stephanie Ball-Bassler from EnableLink.com.
Serving the world from Nashville, Tennessee. This is WOLF-FM.
No, it's not a recording of a commercial radio station, but it certainly could hold its own with the best of them. Wolf FM is one of the almost 10,000 internet radio stations that could be branded personal netcasters. Wolf FM is one of the oldest stations of its kind. It's now a grand 16 months old, and it's one of the most successful. It just so happens that Wolf FM is run by Steve Wolf, who is blind. So, how can you join the radio revolution, as it's called by one of the sites that makes it all possible, live365.com? Well, joining me now to answer that question are three blind people who've made a real success of this personal netcasting business: Steve Wolf of Wolf FM, Kevin Miner of TWD FM, and Michael Gorman of Mike's Mess. Let's start with you, Steve. Since you were on the air first, how did you get started in all of this?
Well, it started, I saw it the 1st of January, read about it on the site and looked around and tried to find documentation on how to set it up, and that was very scarce. Messed around with it for a couple of weeks off and on, just looking at the site, not even downloading anything, and I finally decided to go ahead and try it, and I was successful with my first stream on January 18th of 1999 at like 1:15 in the afternoon, 1:20. And all I did is end up streaming a CD that I had playing in the CD-ROM drive of the computer. And I'd always wanted to get back into broadcasting, looking for some kind of alternative, either low-power FM or something along those lines. And then when I read about Shoutcast, and of course, at the time I was running a cable modem, I thought, this would be perfect. I could put my station back on, because I had a cable FM station in South Texas, where I used to live. And so I decided I'd like to do something again, and found that. It was the perfect tool to do it. And I broadcasted from the cable modem for the longest time, and then, in late March or April of 99, the at-home cable modem service decided to put a cap on the upstream of 128K, which meant I could only have like 5 or 6 listeners to my stream. So, and I just ran it like that for the longest time, and then Live 365 came along.
Okay, so how easy was it to attract listeners in those early days? Because I guess just about everybody who was looking at Shoutcast was also trying to use it. So were listeners a bit scarce at that time?
Oh, very much so. We only had, in the beginning, we were lucky if we got 3 or 4, and it did that for the longest time, even on our server here. And when we went to Live 365, it was the same thing, 3 or 4 or 5 people. At that time, you had a maximum cap of 100 listeners, and it was on August 18th of 99. I will remember it well. It was, oh, what a day. I was getting ready to leave to go out, and normally the listener count, like I said, the most we ever had was like 12 or 13, something like that. And I went over and checked the computer, and all of a sudden it said 28, and I was like, whoa, what's this? And it just kept going up. From August 18th of last year, it's just been going up ever since.
You're now one of the most popular MP3 streamers. I guess we can't say Shoutcast stations anymore because Live 365 doesn't use Shoutcast, and they have chosen not to list their sites now on shoutcast.com. But you're still one of the most popular MP3 streamers out there. You were peaking at around about, 360 listeners at one point.
Oh yeah, absolutely. When they were still listing on Shoutcast, that was our peak number. Now we're still in the top 10. We're in the lower top 10. We're probably number 7 or 8 of the stations on Live 365 anyways. And probably we're at least in the top 20 as far as total Shoutcast stations. I think we could get the popularity back if we had the listing there, but since they have the disagreement and they're trying to work it out with the AOL/Shoutcast people, then until then, we're going to maintain somewhat of a lower profile. But, I mean, our listener count is still hitting in the daytime anywhere from 120 to 140 listeners in the day during the day, and that's on our 56K stream. And then we have a secondary 24K stream, and that gets anywhere from 15 to 20 listeners during the day.
How about you, Kevin? How did you get started in all of this?
Well, actually, with me, it was kind of a unique situation in that I have a music collection, never been in radio in my life. It's something I've always wanted to do, but I have a very large music collection. And I happened to read about this, the ability to do Shoutcast at this website called HereToday.com. I don't know if you know anything about that, Jonathan. I say that kind of knowing that you put it together
it
there.
It does ring a vague bell, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it would. But read about that, about how you can set up your own internet broadcast using Shoutcast. And I thought, well, that sounds like something fun to do. And so I did it, and my first successful broadcast was in about first part of August of 99. And then I noticed about these things called an e-machine, which is a PC that you can get at a very low cost in exchange for signing up for some internet service. And so I did that and decided, well, I'd like to try to get this thing going 24/7. And my broadcast is not as nearly as professional or high profile as Steve's there, but I just like to just put music out there that people can listen to, and as you said, I've had some somewhat unique experiences with actually doing live broadcasting during a little phenomenon we had here called Hurricane Floyd.
Let's come back to that shortly. Just tell me what TWDFM stands for those who don't recall.
Okay, it stands for the world's definitely finest music, and it can be about a little bit of everything and anything. I have about a 5,000 song selection I can pull from at any one time. So it can be 50s to 80s, country, classical, rap. I think there might be a Christmas song or two in there that I may have not gotten rid of from the holidays or something.
And Mike, you're running a couple of Live 365 stations, I think.
Yeah, actually, now I'm running three. I'm running two oldies from the 50s and 60s, which I got started doing it back in last summer when I read about Live 365 and downloaded a plugin, and I was using the Pentium 166. I couldn't really do stereo or anything, and would just do it on the weekend and tell people to check it out. And then they started out with EasyCast, and I said, well, this will make it a lot easier. And by that time, I had my DSL, so I just basically cut some of my own songs from my own vinyl collection, which is like 4,000 records I collected since I was a kid, to stuff I gotten off the internet and news groups and stuff, and started putting those up using EasyCast. And then I started doing the old-time radio one, which was actually a secondary thing, and the only reason I started doing that was because I think by that time you were doing the new ACV radio, and there wouldn't, you know, as much, but there were some people that were running old-time radio shows, and they were running basically the same one. In fact, there's still somebody running the Cinnamon Bears listed. But I guess he's early for Christmas. But I decided, well, I can change mine once a week and once every other week, and I think that I get more popularity because I kind of run a different, all different types of radio shows, including newscasts and stuff, and try to update them and change them every other week. And now I'm running a all music oldies of that's on my 24K feed as a 56K for DSL and stuff and broadband stereo. So, and it's just music on that one. There's no promos or anything. The other oldies feed I have does have promos, and the old time radio so far does not. And I just started doing it for the fun of it, and now it's become a lot more fun. I just got me a new machine, so it's making it a heck of a lot easier to do now.
Okay, let's deal with some of the equipment involved so that if people are interested in doing this for themselves, they can find out exactly what the different options are. Steve, I guess you would probably be the person out of the three of you that we have on who's invested the most in terms of hardware in this. What kind of gear do you have to make Wolf FM sound like it does?
I have broke the bank putting Wolf FM on the air. It is... I have taken my, as I put it to people on the mail list, I put my every last drop of blood, sweat, and dollar into this thing. Wolf FM consists of three computers, two of which do the actual streaming itself, one for the 24K stream and one for the 56K stream. Then the third computer is actually where all the MP3s are stored on a 20 gig hard drive. The audio leaves that computer, goes to an external rack of processing where it makes the audio sound nice and even and level, and it does compression and limiting, and there's a de-esser unit, AGC unit, that's an automatic gain control, and it goes all from that rack of processing back to the data servers and then out to the net from there. In between that, we have a full studio set up with the board and microphone and mini discs and CD players and tape decks and all that stuff, so we could do a live show. We've done a few, not too many. Pretty much everything is automated, but we have the ability to go in and do live programming, as well as take live phone calls on the air and that sort of thing. It's been a pretty huge investment, but I decided once I realized the power of the technology that I was going to pull out all the stops and try to maximize things as much as possible for the sound quality and reliability factor, as well as the actual equipment to get it to the net. I'm on my third high-speed provider in the past 8 months. I started it out with the cable modem. I switched to ADSL service from the phone company, switched from that to another SDSL service from a local company here, and switched to that to a national SDSL provider. And that's where I've been so far. And if things don't work out in the next day or so, I'm going to be dumping them too. So it's been ridiculous to try to find reliable internet service that's consistent and will get the stream to Live 365 to send it out from there. That has been the hardest part of the whole process.
And so once you've sent it up to Live 365, then the listeners actually connect to Live 365, and you can have up to 365 listeners per stream at any one time.
Yeah, that's right. And for a while, because we were having such high listener traffic, they actually increased our max number to 500. But then they knocked that back when they pulled the listings off Shoutcast, because obviously we weren't getting near that traffic to justify keeping it at 500. So we're back down to 365 for both streams.
And do you get compliments from people? Because when people tune into Wolf FM, they can definitely hear the sort of fat, professional, processed, even sound that all of that equipment is producing. So do people respond to that?
Oh, absolutely. I get tons of email. I tried one of my computers that I actually, when I first started shoutcasting for a long time, I ran everything off one computer. I ran a CD disc changer, 25 disc player, and I transmitted the signal on low power FM from one room to the other and used it to pick up a receiver and transmit and put the audio into the 24K machine because I was running 24K at the time. And I did email, net cruising, shoutcasting, did it all on one computer. And so I wanted to go back and pull some of that listener mail I'd received on that machine off of there and kind of compile it all in one place. And I was amazed. There was over 150 messages just on the one computer. And I hadn't realized how much mail I'd gotten over time. But people like it. I mean, it has a professional sound to it that I'm 29 years old. I grew up in the 80s with the 80s music format. That was my thing. So we throw in some 70s, primarily 80s, and some stuff from today, and we just kind of give it that top 40 80s sound to it, and that's kind of what I wanted to achieve.
Broadcasting from the 20 and Grand high-rise building in downtown Nashville, this is WOLF-FM. WOLF-FM. The Wolf.
You mentioned your e-machine, Kevin. What else is involved in putting TWD-FM on the air?
Well, there's a 27 gig hard drive that I use for nothing but music, and it came with a 4 gig hard drive, which I have the station IDs and that on. And when I first started out, I was using the good old 56K modem, which if you've never shoutcast with that or done any broadcasting with that, it's an experience because the phone lines, unfortunately, aren't the most reliable thing if you're trying to keep the station up 24/7. So needless to say, I'm at work, and I'm listening to the broadcast, see how it's doing, and next thing I know, it goes away, which means I come home, and sure enough, the phone line gets tied up or gets hung up or whatever, and I have to go and reset everything and reboot sometimes and that. But since mid-February, I've had a DSL connection. It's an SDSL 144-kilobit line, so I could go up to 56K, but I keep mine at 24 because there are some people that still have just 56K or even less that I'd like to have them have the ability to hear the stream if they want to. So I probably don't have as many listeners, but that's okay. It's just something I'm doing for the fun of it, and it's a blast. I've gotten a few emails from it, and especially during the summer, I have got quite a few from all sorts of folks.
In terms of audio compression and things, are you doing any of that in software with programs like Audio Stocker to keep the levels even and give you that fat compressed sound?
Right, yeah, I'm using Audio Stocker, which is a plug-in for Winamp, which is the player that I use to broadcast. And it does give it a very nice sound. I have also experimented with the Crossfader plug-in, which will blend, it gives that radio sound where the songs blend right one if after the other, but I had some problem with that, mainly that I couldn't tell if the stream was connected or not, although now I could probably switch to that and it would be something safe I could do.
So both of you, Steve and Kevin, are using Winamp as the heart of all of this. Not only can Winamp play MP3 files, and of course many of those listening to you now are listening to Winamp, but Winamp is, if you like, an internet radio transmitter, if you like, if you download the right software to make that happen.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's the way I use to do not only the actual streams, but I use that to play the MP3s as well. And it works well along with I don't use Audio Stalker, but I do use a Crossfader, the out SQR Crossfader. It's not the Nullsoft one. It was written by a third party, and it works quite well.
The other interesting thing is that you can tell Winamp, of course, not to put your stream that you're playing locally through your sound card, which means that if you want to broadcast and, say, listen to another shoutcast stream or a real audio stream or whatever, then you can actually do that because it doesn't have to take up your sound card if you use shoutcast in its most basic form.
Yeah, it's true. If you use it with the null output plug-in and then start another instance of Winamp and set it back to the wave output plug-in, yeah, you can do that. I used to do that in the early days, But since now I got everything, the station's off on its own three machines sitting by itself, and then I have another computer just to play on the net with to do email and net cruising and that sort of thing. I don't have to mess with it, because that's one of the things with shoutcasting. When you run a live stream or a continuous stream like that to Live 365 or to another relay server or something like that, it's better to have the machine off by itself, because though the stuff is not processor intensive, it doesn't use a lot of resources, a lot of stuff can conflict with it and it can get flaky. So I used to have a problem in the middle of the day. The only way to pull my current listener numbers was to load Shoutcast with Internet Explorer. And every once in a while in the middle of the afternoon when I'd go to load the stats, all of a sudden, boom, we'd get a blue screen and the whole station would go down.
And for those people who were throwing up their hands in horror and thinking, gosh, I can't afford to do this, the equipment's too expensive, it all sounds too complicated, then we come to Mike, who has another solution thanks to Live 365. And perhaps you can explain how you're doing your radio stations, Mike.
Yeah, sure. Well, basically, I take MP3 files that I either make or have, and I upload them to Live365's EasyCast server. You upload it to there, and you can have it set to shuffle, play in random order, or play in whatever order you want it to. I will assure you, if you don't have a DSL, this will take you all day to do, or all week to do, pretty much. I put up about 100 songs a week, so with the DSL, it takes about an hour or two or three. When I had the 56K modem, I did it through my computer like the other two are doing, but not as well because of my limited computer capacity. But with Live 365 and the EasyCast, they now allow you to use a program called Easy Loader. Now, I haven't tried it with speech, but it pretty much looks speech-friendly.
It's perfect.
And they also, yeah, that's what I thought. And you can still use your FTP site. They do allow you an FTP site. You have to write them, apparently, for a password, but you can use it that way. You can only upload up to 56 kilobits, and the Easy Loader will convert your bigger files to that small kilobit rate and then upload it to the server. And then you go into their server through their webpage, and, or through your web, yeah, through their webpage, and pick which song you want to play for the netcast, and just hit save and create a list, and hit broadcast now. And this doesn't require hardly any money, other than the computer you have and the internet connection. And it's basically, once you figure it out, and it's not really that hard to do, it can be pretty easy and for me a lot of fun.
This is Jan Sturbins. Join me in listening to the best, Mike's Oldies, on Live365.com.
Steve, are you looking to make money out of this? You've obviously invested a lot. Are you looking for a return?
Well, yeah, I am. The thing, only thing I would like to have it do is at least, at the bare minimum, subsidize the cost of my DSL connection. That's pretty much it. I mean, I'd like to have it make money. By no means, I don't want to get rich off the thing, but I'd like to have it make a little bit to, you know, buy more music and update the equipment and maybe take a nice vacation once a year. But, you know, I certainly don't want to get rich off the thing, and by the way it's going, I'm certainly not going to either.
Mind you, as soon as you took your vacation, you'd have a cellular modem dialing in to make sure the thing was still up, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. There'd be some vacation, especially if it crashed, I'd be fretting to get back home to fix it.
But I noticed that you are moving into money-making ventures on your site. There's some e-commerce stuff. You've got an electronics store, I guess through an affiliate program, and different other ways to try and generate revenue there.
Well, yeah, we've got a banner ad program, and I can assure you that doesn't pay anything. That was a big disappointment. That was supposed to have a much higher return than it is. The affiliate program with the electronic store, we basically handle home audio stuff, things like that. That's actually generated very little. The only thing that's really generated some traffic that I've seen is our CD store online, where you can also get music. That's done pretty good from what I understand. I'm just waiting to get paid from it now.
Is it like you get a percentage?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You get a commission, and then they send you a check every so often. Now, I'm due to receive something from the people I have the banner ad for, but it was supposed to be CPMs, or click per thousand. How many 1,000 hits to the website, you get paid so much. And they promised me anywhere between $3 and $10 per 1,000 visitors, and it's turned out to be at the most $1.20, so it's not a whole lot.
That's interesting. So do you have stats that measure how many hits a week your site's getting?
Yes. When we were on Shoutcast, we were getting anywhere from 1,200 to 1,500 hits a day. And now it's down to about 150 to 200 hits a day to the website.
Okay. How about you, Kevin? Are you looking to turn this into some sort of profit venture?
Well, it would, if I was going to do anything with it, probably the way I would like to go was more of a local thing where, and I haven't really done much with it because I've been more of focusing, converting everything over to MP3s. But my thought was setting up something where somebody was in the local area and would like to have someone do weddings or something. They could tune into the station, hear what I have, and then, oh, by the way, if you'd like me to do this for you, here's some way to get a hold of me, and I could do that.
And how about you, Mike? Are you looking at making some sort of money?
Not right this moment. I figured if this keeps going in a year or so, I might start considering it. How I'm going to do it, I don't know yet, but at the moment, I'm just doing it for fun, but I think, you know, as it keeps going, and I've done it for a few months, and I haven't wanted to stop, so if it keeps going like a year or so, I'll probably think of some way of making money on it. Because I got to pay back what I owe.
Absolutely. One of the things that's interested me, Steve, is that really there has not been the kind of exponential growth that I would have expected in Shoutcast listeners. I've been involved with this like you from day one, and I'm somewhat surprised by the fact that there aren't more people listening to Shoutcast, really. Are you surprised by that too?
Yeah, it did for a while. It took a huge growth. It was jumping by thousands, and then it seemed to level off. I would think the Shoutcast people are talking about promoting it more with AOL, since they're kind of one of the same now. And if that happens, I think you will see the listener traffic pick up. Live365 has done some things to promote their end of it, their broadcasting thing, with the Roadrunner cable modem service. They've taken some ads out in magazines and even some radio ads from what I hear. But
I heard one up here.
Ah, okay. They just haven't taken enough. They haven't taken enough initiative in the marketing department. I've been discussing that with them quite heavily lately, due to the fact that our listener count took such a major hit. And they assure me that they're working on marketing schemes to make the public more aware of their service and things to listen to.
Maybe one of you, for those who aren't familiar with the directory system, can explain how the Live365 and Shoutcast directories actually work.
Well, basically what happens is when you run a Shoutcast server, Shoutcast is actually the tool to send a live stream, and Shoutcast.com is the directory server where the stations are listed, or one of them. What happens normally when you run the Shoutcast server software is it takes your station name and the maximum amount of listeners you can have on your station and the current amount of listeners you have and sends it to the Shoutcast.com directory server, and it's posted on a list that everybody can see. Well, it's the same way with Live365. If you send a stream to them, they have a directory server that posts your station name, also your website too, that's in there, maximum number of listeners you can have on your station, and your current number of listeners. Well, the big controversy has been, and what's hurt the listenership, is before March 16th, Live365, when you sent a stream to them, they would take that same station information and send it on to Shoutcast.com, so you were listed on those two directory servers. Well, as of March 16th, they decided to not list on Shoutcast.com anymore. And being that Shoutcast was the first, the main thing, that's where everybody went to look for stations. So now with no Live365 stations basically appearing on Shoutcast, it's nobody knows to find you anymore. And not very many people are going to Live365.com, not like they'd like to think there are. So that's how the directory server works, and that's how it's basically an online index of streaming audio stations that you can listen to. It's like a big directory, and it really directs a lot of traffic to you. It really helps out. So when Live365 chose not to do that, when they decided to pull out, it really took a big bite out of everybody.
I suppose that because Live365 is giving away this ridiculous amount of bandwidth for free, and anybody who's tried to do this completely independently will know how expensive this is, I suppose I've got to get traffic to the site to keep the advertisers happy, and maybe pulling out of the directory was the only way to do that.
Well, that was part of it. That was the big thing. That, and I had a big argument with them based on that, saying, well, what do you mean? So the listeners have to go to your site and see your banner ads? And, you know, I basically heard a rumor that their bandwidth cost was in excess of $50,000 a month. And I said, so you're trying to fund a project of this magnitude based on banner ads? And incidentally, the same people that are buying the banner space on my site are the same ones on Live 365. And I know what they pay. And I'm like, there's no way. How can you fund a project of this magnitude based on that? But they assure me there are other things in the works that will help us to, you know, to get back, to perhaps get back on Shoutcast and other means of funding, and even, you know, all sorts of advertising deals to work out that may even benefit the broadcasters as well.
I wonder if there's a possibility that at some point Live 365 will ask us to play audio ads in the Live 365 streams.
That's actually in the works right now.
So they will require that?
They will require it. They're still working on it. Nothing's been officially released. This is all through sources over there that I've talked to, but they are working on it. They're working on it. That will be coming.
Okay. Kevin, last year during the Hurricane Floyd disaster where you were, you provided an incredibly useful public service, and it got you a lot of media publicity and really showcased the power of this medium. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. Well, to give you the idea, I'd have to go back actually about a year and a half ago when Raleigh, we had another storm called Hurricane Bonnie that they thought was going to hit, and I decided to stay at work because I'm a ham radio operator, and try and relay what information I could back and forth to let people know what was going on at work and maybe contact family and friends if need be. Well, this past year when I started the stream, it occurred to me that rather than me being this liaison for work, why not get this information directly to them? And Live 365 was a good way to do it. So when Hurricane Floyd was coming through, I decided, well, I'm going to go ahead and do it and see what happens. And at first, I wasn't ever planning on publicizing it because I thought, well, I don't know if I want to have all these listeners. But the morning that I started the broadcast of the ham radio stream, I decided to go ahead and publicize it and see what happened. And from there on, it really got the publicity. And in fact, it occurred to me that during the storm itself, that this actually might help some of the ham operators themselves, because they had a VHF link that went down at one of the sites in eastern North Carolina where they were really getting a lot of damage from the storm. Raleigh just got the edge of the storm, which still did a bit, but not that much. But that's when I thought, well, if somebody there, maybe they couldn't get the local repeater, but they could get a internet connection and still pick up the feed that way and get information. And it really, I'm amazed at how well it did. I got a person that used to live in the Raleigh area that is a news reporter who listened to it, and several other people from all over said, well, I have family in this area, and it's really a great way to get information quickly.
Let me ask each of you then to give some advice to people who might be considering getting involved in this, I guess from a number of perspectives. Firstly, what does it take to attract listeners? Because you're all
kids
pretty successful
at this.
and secondly, you know, what would you say to people in terms of equipment or doing it right? Any kind of advice you would give to blind people wanting to get into this? We'll start with you, Mike.
Well, the best thing I could do is to suggest it. Do what I did. Just check it out first. Listen to other people doing screens. See what they're doing. If you think you can do something different, give it a try. And check out how to do EasyCast and do some tests before you officially give it out to the public. And that way you'll know things are going right, which is what I did. And then, you know, give it out to friends and post it in news groups and whatever. And hopefully you'll get listeners. And then, you know, word of mouth or whatever will hopefully get you there.
That's interesting. So you benchmark, as it were. You look at other shoutcast stations and their websites and find out what they're doing and what works and perhaps where there's a niche for you.
Right. I wanted to try to be different because I've heard, you know, other people doing seven. In fact, I really like Steve Netcast. He did a very good job. But I checked the people who were doing oldies, and I noticed that there weren't too many people doing really 50s, early 60s. So that's what got me to do that idea, and I figured even if it wasn't a big audience, you know, it would be an audience that wasn't really listening before. And I, like, Steve, I get an email once in a while from people who either say they haven't heard a song in a long time or they're impressed with what I do and stuff, and it helps. It keeps it going. And like I said, I usually check to see, you know, what other netcasters or what other broadcasters were doing, and I decided to try to do something different.
Well, I guess the big advice I would give is the thing I learned listening to my netcast. I used to do some things like trivia and then on the some of the promos I do, and what I found with mine is I wanted to listen to music on mine because my thought was part of the reason I do it is it's these having to lug all these CDs and stuff around to work or wherever, and I can just listen to it over an internet connection. So I thought, I just want to mainly do music and make the IDs very short, so that's what I did. But, you know, like Mike says, that word of mouth and getting it to family. And I agree with him. Test the stream before you publicize it. I know there was a couple of times I thought I had everything worked out, and it's interesting looking at those emails I sent at that time, realizing some of the little mishaps in that you have run into getting it started, but it's sure been fun doing it.
How about you, Steve? What advice would you offer?
Well, first thing I would say from the technical aspect of it is make sure you know your screen reader real well. A lot of these plugins and some of these programs aren't exactly speech friendly. But for the most part, they are, but you can run into problems with some of the plugins and things like that. So it helps to have a real firm knowledge of your screen reader and screen navigation skills. It is a good idea to go around and check out other netcasts and things. I still do that. I love to jump around. I love to listen to other netcasts. I enjoy the heck out of that. To me, it's almost like DX and shortwave. You can hear all kind of neat stuff and programs. I love the live stuff. I really love live talk, call-in shows, things like that. I've heard several neat ones on the net. So it gets a real, gives you a good idea of what everybody's doing and what the flavors are out there. And if you want to do something similar or different, whatever, it just gives you an idea of what the atmosphere is like. As far as the technical aspect of it, you can make it as simple as you want or you can make it as complicated as you want. It depends on how dedicated you want to be to it and what kind of budget you have to work with. I mean, I consider mine to be pretty sophisticated, and it's definitely given me a few more gray hairs, I'll tell you. It's kind of a double-edged sword with all the equipment. There's more equipment just means more to go wrong. But it just depends on how sophisticated and complicated and expensive you want to take it. But it can be done quite cheaply, actually. I mean, one or two computers, and especially with the EasyCast thing like Mike's doing, I mean, that requires basically very little in the way of hardware, because you can upload all the files. You don't need to really store them on your machine. You can upload them to Live365 and do that.
Right, I get to hear my own netcast.
Exactly. So, I mean, and you free up your resources there at your house. So,
mm-hmm.
That's the way to do it there in that case, but it's and there's a lot of documentation out there. Another thing I encourage people to do is to read all the documentation available. There's things at Live365 and various other locations where you can learn how to do it. A lot of tutorials and frequently asked question lists and things like
Actually,
that.
Actually, I did that too. After a little bit of time, I started reading them, and that's what got me even learning how to do it more.
Exactly. It's very helpful, and there's a lot of people I know that kind of jump the gun and say, oh, how do I do this? I want to do this right now. And there's so many, and it irritates a lot of people because, you know, Jonathan, I'm sure you can relate. When we first started doing this, there was no facts or documentation files. Man, I went to the Shopcast site and reread documentation files and little snippets of things, and you could tell the whole system was written by people that worked in Linux and Unix because they automatically expected you to know how to do it. And when you asked a question like, well, what does that mean? I need that line recording plugin. What's that all about? And they're like, well, you don't know you need that? Why are you asking us? You know? So it really got to be nerve-wracking. But I finally, after messing with it for a few days, consistently figured out exactly what I needed and how to install everything. And once I got the stream up and a few people heard it that were actually also running internet stations, they emailed me, and then I could kind of pick their brains a little bit with getting advice on stuff too.
When I first started my webpage about 2 years ago, I started doing an oldie of the day using Real Audio Encoder, and it took me a month. Somebody sent me a letter on how to do it, and I sat there and looked at the letter, and I just couldn't figure it out, and I kept looking at it every once in a while. And one day I woke up and I said, now I got it, and then I did it. And it was just so funny because I had the documentation with me, and it just, you know, I just kept picking at it until I finally figured it out.
So let's wrap up by asking each of you to give your web details so people can check it all out. Mike, where can we find your webcast?
Well, I'll just give my webpage. You can go to www.mikesmess.com and go to my collection, and you'll see the Real Player 7 or the Winamp feed of the netcast. Or you can go to Live 365 and look up under various or 50s or 60s, or you can even type in search old time radio or oldie, and you'll find one of my netcasts there.
Kevin, where do we find TWDFM?
Well, there's also a website for me, which is www.twdfm.com. Now, that might not be real easy to remember, so if you think of the word tweed and take the vowels out of it and stick FM at the end of it, that'll tell you how to get there. That'll get you there. And you can also go to Live 365, and I'm under the various, and I believe, pop and 70s and 80s, or you could also do a search, and just you could even do a search for TWD, and that'll get you there.
And Steve, for the 0.5% of the world's population that hasn't visited your site yet, how do people get there?
Oh, I wish. You can go to www.wolffm.com. That's WOLFFM.com. And, of course, you can find it at Live 365 under Wolf, and we're also listed under Pop 70s and 80s for the different genres. So that's where you can find us. And I hope people go and check it out. And like I said, we do offer two streams. So we have the 56K for those that have DSL and the ISDN or whatever. And then we have a 24K stream for the standard dial-up users.
Thanks to Steve Wolf, Michael Gorman, and Kevin Miner for sharing their thoughts on personal webcasting with us on Main Menu. Now, there are some resources as a follow-up to this if you want to investigate further. Of course, you can go to visit Live 365 at www.live365.com. You might also like to join the PC audio discussion list for blind people interested in audio, and that covers listening to as well as broadcasting audio through the PC. To join that list, send a blank email message to pc-audio-request@outofsight.org.nz. That's pc-audio-request@outofsight.org.nz. Just put subscribe in the subject of your message and go ahead and send it. We also have a website, heretoday.com, that deals with audio on the PC, where you can find software downloads and tutorials, www.heretoday, that's heartoday.com. And finally, I've just established a Live 365 users list, and already we have some interesting discussions going on there, including some where we have input from Live 365 staff who will answer questions for you. So to join that, send a message to l365-subscribe@egroups.com. That's l365-subscribe@egroups.com. This is Main Menu on ACB Radio Mainstream. I'm Jonathan Mosen, and still to come before the end of this week's program, we look at Internet Relay Chat. We have a hands-on demonstration of Pulse Data International's new exciting note-taker, the Braille Note, and Matt Campbell takes another look at Linux. Stay with us.
On ACB Radio's Main Menu, this is DJ C at acbradio.org with news and views you can use. And very special greetings to you and welcome to my part of the Main Menu today. This is Don Coco from Sacramento, California. This past week in my email, I had a request to demonstrate the Internet Relay Chat System, or IRC. There are quite a number of servers around the world that one can log into, and quite a number of IRC clients that one can use. There are servers in every single country, and there are clients probably in every flavor, Unix, Linux, and Windows. The Windows clients include MS Chat and Merc. If you have Windows installed, which obviously you do if you're listening to this program, chances are you may have MS Chat installed on your computer. And all this allows you to do is log into a server and join rooms of interest where people have gathered, and you type back and forth. You can also play sounds over a channel, MP3, waves, MIDIs, that sort of thing. You can share files, transfer files back and forth, all kinds of great stuff. It's quite a lot of fun. What I'm going to do is I'm going to log into a server called Deep Space. So if I were on a shell, which I'm not, but if I were on a shell, I might type, this just gives you an idea, IRC space irc.deepspace.org:6667. The number's at the end of the port number. And that's what 6667 means. That's the port number that I'm connecting to. Because the servers are all on different ports, and you have to connect to the port number. As I say, there are servers in every country, every nation, and in every language, I might add, too. You can talk in French, Italian, Spanish, English, German, and so forth. So it's not just limited to English. I have found in the many years of using IRC, there are lots of nice people out there. I also will say there are some flakes out there, too. You need to be aware of that. But that's like any chat community. You know, there's going to be always good and bad. I'm using a client called Mirc, M-I-R-C, here. And I'm using a talking script with Mirc. I talked about this, I know, on Blindline before, but I'll give you a brief history of the script, how it came to be. The way we used to have to use Mirc is we used to have to read up and down on the screen with our mouse pointers. See, what happens is as words scroll on the screen that people are typing, they scroll from the bottom of the screen to the top of the screen. So basically words are scrolling up, not down. It's a little odd, but that's the way they've done it. So new lines appear at the bottom of the screen is what I'm saying here. And the client, we used to have to actually physically read up and down on the screen with the mouse. Well, of course, your fingers get tired doing that. And plus, since Mirc can have any number of people, you can have anywhere from one other person or just yourself to hundreds of people in a room. There doesn't seem to be any limit. At least I've logged into some pretty big rooms, and there doesn't seem to be any limit to the number of people who can chat. And naturally, when you get, you know, 50, 60, 70 people in a room, there's always somebody chatting, so the lines are scrolling like crazy. And, of course, you couldn't read that way. There was no way you could read with speech and keep up with it. When the new Mirc, the latest Mirc that's now being offered, it's Mirc 5.7. When it came out, the author of Mirc, who lives in England, incorporated it with the MS Agent technology. Up until this point, we did not have the MS Agent technology, so we had to read up and down on the screen. I went to one of the Mirc news groups, the group for scripting, the Mirc scripting news group, and I asked there if it would be possible, because I'm not knowledgeable, but if it would be possible for somebody to write a Mirc script for visually impaired persons that would talk. And that's how the script came about. It's a very good script. It works quite well. And the gentleman who wrote it, his name is DJ Fritz. He's a gentleman who lives in Texas, and he was very kind enough to write and perfect and donate this script. We beta tested it, and he added features that I asked for and that sort of thing. And it's been done now for quite a while. It's out there. It's not in the public domain on the net, but if anybody's interested in this, they can just drop email to djc@acbradio.org. That's my new ACB address. djc@acbradio.org. Just put in the subject Mirc script and let me know you're interested in the script, and I'll send it your way. It does have a README, tells you how to install it. It tells you what components you need for the MS Agent stuff. Obviously, you need a character or characters. You need the control panel for the agent. You need the core component for the agent. So those are things you download at Microsoft. So what we're going to do right now is we're going to log into Mirc, and or log into IRC, I should say, using Mirc. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to join a server called Deep Space and join a channel called TalkShop. And because my script is designed to automatically log in, I don't have to do anything except tell it to log in. So Let's do that, and I'm going to come up on near the speakers, and you'll hear the MS agent characters talking, is what you'll hear here. So I've just come up on the server, and now I'm waiting for the server to log me in. Boy, this is so far away, Don. I'm just going to turn this up to make sure you guys can hear it and hope it'll work okay. Here comes the MS agent. It's about to talk here and sounds like this. If it comes up, I'm getting dings.
Welcome to my RCL with DJC. Next set, I noticed that the DJC is not as you started. Sensor removes you as an operator in TalkShip. Sensor changing the copy in TalkShip to welcome to TalkShip. The home for visually impaired people. Enjoy your stay. Sensor sent by notice number TalkShip is operated by Sensor. You have joined TalkShip. The topic is welcome to TalkShip. The home for visually impaired people. Enjoy your stay. The mix in Shenhua. DJC.
And I'm logged into TalkShop here. And I'm by myself. There's nobody else here, so I'm by myself. It's the deal. But there you go. That shows you basically how it works. Now, we can play sound on a channel. We can do all kinds of other things as well. You can play MP3s, waves, MIDIs. You can transfer files. You can do all kinds of things with Merc. If there were other people on the channel, which there's nobody here, but if there was somebody else here, they'd say hello, and I'd type back hello, and we'd go from there. And that's basically how IRC, or Internet Relay Chat, works. Well, that's it for this time around. So on behalf of the main menu, this is DJC at acbradio.org, thanking you for listening. See you next week.
Welcome to this segment of the main menu. My name is Marcel Oates and I'm from Auckland, New Zealand. On April the 13th this year, I was invited to go to the launch of the new device that Pulse Data International Limited here in New Zealand have developed over the last couple of years, called Braille Note. Essentially, it's a Braille note taker with obviously a Braille keyboard for input and either an 18-character or 32-character display and speech for the output. It's an 8-dot Braille keyboard and the Keynote Gold speech. The software runs under Windows CE, and consequently Microsoft have been quite happy that Pulse Data have made Windows CE accessible in a way to the visually impaired people. The fact that it runs under Windows CE also allows such things as a POP3 email client to be available to the user, and also the facility of saving documents in universal formats that are now standard, such as Microsoft Word. On the recording that I'm about to play you, you'll hear me actually writing a document and pretending to email it. We didn't have an internet connection available, but the software went through the motions anyway. The system could be almost thought of as a laptop computer designed for the blind. It's quite portable. Its case is plastic. All the keys are plastic, but they have a good feel to them. The unit has, as I mentioned, an 8-dot Braille keyboard. It also has thumb keys on the front of the unit to control the display. And on the 32-character model of the Braille Note, there are cursor routing keys above each Braille character. The unit is going to go on sale in the US in May, apparently, and should have a suggested price of just under $5,000. For more information, you can contact either HumanWare in the States or you can actually go to the Pulse Data website, which is at www.pulsedata.co.nz, or to the BrailleNote website, which is at www.BrailleNote.com. It's based on a series of menus. So we'll go
main menu.
It's saying main menu, so that's sort of the desktop or the launching point for any anything you want to do. I'll just progress through the options that are on the menu so you can get an idea.
Word processor,
that's for creating and editing documents.
Matter.
Planner is the personal organizer, appointment calendar, etc.
Address list
is where you store phone numbers.
Email.
Book reader is for, for instance, if you had a textbook that you were using in a classroom environment, you'd have it in this this part of the machine. It's like a non-destructive version of the word processor.
Scientific calculator.
Yep. Or doing scientific calculations, funnily enough.
File manager.
File manager is where you do all the erasing of files or sort of copying them. Or
utilities.
And similarly for utilities is the same thing for backing up the machine. And
terminal or screen reader.
So there you go. There's where Russell mentioned that you can use this machine with another computer to give you feedback from the machine's, the other computer's display, and you can use this for your input.
Remote synthesizer.
That just, that's a similar thing.
Keyboard learn.
And if someone needs to learn where things are on the keyboard, they can use that. It just tells you what each key does.
Information.
And that's where all the copyright material is. Now, say we go to
main menu.
I'm just using an express method of getting back to the main menu, but say we select
word processor.
We'll go into the menu.
Keyword menu.
Okay. It'll always tell you what menu you're in at the beginning. So we'll explore the options on the word processor menu now. We've gone down into that particular level.
Create a document.
Okay, we'll do that shortly.
Open a document.
That's if you've got an existing document you wish to read.
Emboss a document.
Now, emboss refers to the idea of actually printing it out on braille paper. So you emboss a copy because it makes dots on the braille paper.
Print a document.
Print a document.
And a menu.
Okay. Each selection of the menu has a hotkey. So from that main menu, I could have hit W to get to the word processor, or S for the scientific calculator. Just to give you an idea of the online help, let's pretend I'm a new person just exploring this machine, and I'm reading on the display here, and I've heard it say end of menu. I'm pushing the key that goes to the right through the options.
End of menu.
Just goes beep. So what do I do now? Well, we can ask for help.
To review the option, press backspace. To select any keyword menu option, no, press its initial letter. End of menu.
Okay, so that's pretty explanatory enough. I haven't been using backspace, but we can use the backspace key to go back.
Print a document. Import a document.
You don't have to listen to it speak the whole thing.
Open a create a document.
Okay, let's go ahead and create a document.
Folder name. Press enter for general.
Now there's the concept, you see, of windows with folders. On the display, on the braille line of characters, it's actually saying folder name, ? Space, and then the whole word general is spelt out. So if you want, you can read all the information coming off the display. So we'll press enter.
Document to create.
Okay, I'm going to call this Marcel. So we'll browse M-A-R-C-E-L on the keyboard.
Marcel, type of document, blank.
And I've got a blank display here, and the speech has similarly said top of document, and it says blank, so there's nothing there. So if I just type a few lines of text here.
This is a demonstration.
I've got to try and spell Braille note right. I think we'll actually just we'll cop out.
Braille.
Because it does really funny things if you put BRLNOTE as one word.
Just as myself typing the
note period
that the Braille translation is occurring as it hits one key, it will expand it to the longhand version of that key, but then as another character is typed, that is replaced with a better estimate. So the Braille translation is going on constantly. He is typing in grade 2 or contracted form, and it is back translating to display normal text and to speak, obviously, normal text.
We are showing this.
Oops, I just made a mistake.
E.
Oh no, it didn't even get onto the.
Neil.
Yeah, okay, well, we'll actually fix that. I think we'll actually just fix it the simple way.
And the file. W.
I mean, of course, I don't have to do that much.
E.
I've just made an error, so I'm just correcting it on the machine here.
Device. To the. Media period new line. I'm sure you're all very
thank you.
Impressed period new line.
Okay, we've got ourselves a document. We can navigate through the document going backwards.
I'm sure you're all very impressed.
Sentence by sentence, reading the whole document if we want to. So you get a general idea. I can read that line of characters on the display. I can tell where the new line is. Above the display are keys to move the cursor to any character of the display. For instance, here we are. It's underneath the A of all. So we have a document. What can we do with it? Well,
exit keyword menu.
We're just climbing back up through the menu structure now. We've exited from the word processor.
Exit main menu.
Okay. Let's say we've written ourselves a very important thesis on the merits of having a guide dog.
Word process planner.
Well, we want to send it to somebody.
Address list. Email.
So let's go ahead and select the email function.
Email menu.
Okay.
Write an email.
That's a good idea.
Read email. Connect to a service.
You get the general idea. We'll hit the W character, which will write an email.
Send to.
We will now select a few names from the address book that was also part of this machine. So you might have someone's names and phone numbers stored as well as their email address. Speaking of phones.
Selection list or address list.
Okay.
All records selected. Send to all selected recipients.
Now, that's generally not a good idea, especially if you've got 54 records in your address book. So we'll type N for no.
No, Rose Wilson.
Okay. If we want to select them, we just press the Enter key.
Address added. George Brown.
Okay, we might not want to select them. So.
Robert Green.
Perhaps not.
Russell Smith.
Oh, we might as well.
Address added. No more machine entry.
Okay,
Russell Smith.
It did two things. It made the beep, the error beep, and it said no more matching entries, which is what the error was, and it's telling you the address is added.
Exit selection list or address list. Exit also sent to.
Okay, now, also send to. I could send this email to anybody if I had their address, but we don't really need to.
Copy to.
That's like your. Making a copy of CC, if you like.
Blind copy to.
And that's like a BCC, so you know how you're filling your fields in the Microsoft Outlook or Exchange or Eudora or whatever.
Subject.
Okay, this is a subject field. It's what is the subject of the email. Demonstration. Press the Enter key.
Demonstration. Attach a file to this email.
Okay. On the display, again, it's saying attach a file to this email, so we'll hit yes.
Yes. Folder name. Press enter for general.
Okay, this is a similar prompting to the word
file to attach. Press enter for Marcel.
Now, this is the user friendliness side of things. Because we were last editing that file that I created initially, it's selected it automatically to send. Okay, so we'll hit the enter key.
Attach this keyword document in a different file type?
Yes.
Yes, attach as a Microsoft Word file.
We might as well do that. We're in a list, so we could select another format, but we won't. We'll just press enter.
Attach another file?
No, we don't want to.
No, email message. Top of document.
Okay.
Blank.
I don't know, please. Oops.
ST. Please. Find. Attach my paper on.
Yeah, that'll do.
Battery period new length.
Okay, exit.
Exit. Ready to send this email?
I guess we are. Now, of course, when we try to send this, nothing will happen.
Yes, save a copy.
Oh, no.
No, email menu.
Okay. We send the. We've written our mail. We need to send it.
Write an email.
There are two ways we can do that. We'll just do it the way that I did it earlier on.
There are two email in the outbox. Send no.
Now that's because I went out of the email part of the software, but it knows that there are messages waiting. So if we type yes.
Yes, service to call. Press enter for clear.
Okay.
Dialing.
Nothing's going to happen here because there is no telephone plugged in.
No carrier.
Okay.
Main menu.
That's just the modem error message. But assuming that we had a connection to the internet, we'd just have sent this email message that we've created.
Russell Smith was the other voice you heard in that recording of me demonstrating BrailleNote to the rest of the press and some TV cameras too, by the way. We managed to get onto a slot on one of our major channels' news programs. The unit goes into full production and on sale apparently next month for a suggested price of just under $5,000 US for the 32 character display model and somewhere in the $3,000 area for the 18 character display model. I'm not sure that that's actually that price has been determined. I think this unit's going to be revolutionary for blind people who don't want to learn how to use a computer, because they might be able to treat it more as an aid rather than a full computer system. So there you are. I hope you've enjoyed this particular segment. If you'd like to make email comments about it, they're always welcome. My email address is moats@rnzfb.org.nz. That's moats@rnzfb.org.nz. And thanks for listening.
Thanks to Marcel Oates for his demonstration of one of the hot topics of CSUN, Pulse Data International's BrailleNote.
Hello, this is Matt Campbell, and welcome to another look at Linux. This week, I'm going to demonstrate the installation of ZipSpeak, a talking mini distribution of Linux, which you can install on a current DOS or Windows system. I have running right now Windows 98 2nd Edition, the demo of the Window Bridge 2000 screen reader, and a DoubleTalk LT speech synthesizer. And so, let's go ahead and start the installation. The first thing you need to do is unzip a file called zipspeak.zip into the root directory of the drive you're installing the system on. And I'll be installing mine on drive C. Now, if you have the old PK unzip for DOS, that probably won't work. I've seen many reports that people can't use it because there's insufficient memory, and I couldn't get it to work myself. The unzip program I use is InfoZip, which is available for both DOS and 32-bit Windows, and I have a 32-bit Windows version, which is a console application, meaning that it runs in a DOS box, but under the hood it uses Windows. So, I'm going to unzip the zipspeak.zip file, which I have in the download directory of my C drive. I'm redirecting the output from null so that the synthesizer will stay quiet so I can talk about a few things while the file is unzipping. First, let's talk about what speech synthesizers are supported by SpeakUp, which is the screen reader that ZipSpeak is using. SpeakUp supports in its current version the Accent PC, Accent SA, Double Talk, Light Talk, and SpeakOut speech synthesizers. More synthesizers are in the works, including the Adapter, the Apollo, the Arctic Transport, the Braille and Speak, the DAC Talk Express, and the DAC Talk External. Hope I haven't forgotten any. The DAC Talk PC is going to be very difficult to support under SpeakUp because it has to have some additional files like dictionaries to make it go. And SpeakUp starts up before the file system on the hard drive is even available. So I think it'll be a while before the DAC Talk PC is supported. Software synthesizers aren't yet supported under SpeakUp. If you don't have a software synthesizer, then you'll need to have a sighted person, or at least a partially sighted person like me, help you install the system and then use Emacs Speak, because it does support two software synthesizers. One of them is Ambrola, which is put out by a university in Belgium, and it actually uses the same type of technology as the new RealSpeak from LearnOut and HowSpeak, in the sense that it actually uses recordings of a human voice. And also, IBM Via Voice Out Loud is available for Linux, and Emacs Speak supports it. And I understand that it is derived from the Eloquence synthesizer, which you get when you buy JAWS for Windows, or when you use the demo for that matter. On BlindLine this past week, Jonathan made a comment about adaptive technologies coexisting under Linux and running at the same time. And his discussion was in reference to a screen reader and an optical character recognition program. Now, we don't have OCR software ready to use under Linux yet, but one thing that people may want to know about is whether they can run SpeakUp and Emacs Speak at the same time. And the answer is currently yes, but you can't use them both with the same synthesizer. So probably you'll use SpeakUp with a hardware synthesizer like a Double Talk or an Accent, and then you'll use Emacs Speak with a software synthesizer like IBM Via Voice Out Loud. And you can turn off SpeakUp just before you start Emacs Speak so that they don't both speak at the same time. The ZipSpeak file is done unzipping, so the next step is to copy the appropriate kernel image for my synthesizer into the Linux directory on my C drive. And since I'm using a Double Talk LT, the appropriate kernel image is called LTLK, and you can find out all about this in the zipspeak.txt file, which is included in the distribution. So, I've got the LTLK file in my download directory, and I'm going to copy it to a file called dmlinuz.spk in the Linux directory.
And at next week's Look at Linux, Matt Campbell finishes the installation of ZipSpeak, the talking version of Linux, by showing us how to modify the startup batch file, and that involves introducing us to the concept of how drive names are referenced under Linux. Matt now has his own email address here at ACB Radio. If you have any questions, you can drop him an email at matt matt@acbradio.org. That's matt@acbradio.org. That concludes this week's edition of Main Menu. If you have any comments or questions about the program, we're always keen to hear from you. If you've got any suggestions about items you'd like us to cover, please drop us an email. The address is support@acbradio.org. That's support@acbradio.org.
Main Menu.
Main Menu.
Main Menu.
Main Menu.
I hope you've enjoyed this edition of Main Menu. Until we meet again next week, I'm Jonathan Mosen saying bye for now.